Hello everyone and welcome back to the Stats for Lefties podcast. Got a very interesting episode this month where I'm interviewing Rebecca Wilkes, who is a Welsh freelance journalist, used to write for The National before it closed down. And we talked about a lot of interesting stuff. Welsh Labour Party, landlords, housing, Welsh politics, and more. I definitely learnt a lot from this discussion, and I think that you will too. So the first part of this is free, and if you want to hear the full extended episode with a little bit more fun content, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/leftystats from £2 a month. Let's get into it. The first question I was hoping to ask was, you're obviously a freelance journalist now, but you used to work for The National. And most of the people that I speak to or know are people who have worked for independent outlets, but The National was a mainstream media outlet, would be fair to say?
Yes, yeah, because it was run by NewsQuest, which is a big like multinational publisher.
Yeah. So what was your experience of that like? Because I don't have much experience with mainstream media publications.
I think I was kind of lucky in a sense because it was so NewsQuest set up The National not long before I joined. It was quite a new publication. It was done to be a sister publication of the more well-established Scottish National. And because of that sort of, because it was still getting set up and things, there was a certain freedom that I think I had there that you might not have gotten working at sort of other sort of similar sort of mainstream news companies. There's just a certain freedom to like pitch whatever I liked at first. Aside from that sort of bit of fortune and also the security of having a full-time reporting job, which is rarer and rarer at the moment. The way that newsrooms and stuff is set up at the moment makes it very difficult for you to do a good job in the sense that time is at a premium. So you get pretty steep targets for your output, you know. They might want you to like put out 5 articles per day. Yeah, I think mine wasn't quite that high. That was where they were eventually aiming for. I was sort of put, you know, 2 to 3 per day, but they wanted to get you up to 5. And you'll find a lot of like local news sites, like my colleagues who worked in publications like the South Wales Argus and stuff like that. You know, the more local news stuff, like they're on targets that can be as high as 5 articles per day. I know, you know, some places will even like push it up to 7 per day, and it means that the time to do the job is very thin because you're fitting that all into a normal like 9-to-5 shift, which means it is very difficult. And also the job is not particularly well paid either. I at the moment, as I'm, you know, trying to get set up as a freelancer, I'm working in retail, just, you know, doing cashier stuff. And the money I made as a journalist working full time, you know, pro rata, wasn't really that much more than I make now. Particularly when you think like, you know, you do a 9-to-5 shift, but you end up, you know, you're working on stuff in your own time as well. So it's very difficult. If we're going to see journalism, you know, as a viable industry that does the purpose that it's supposed to do, I think you're going to need to see a sort of a lot sort of more blanket union membership and like union, like being an active member of the NUJ.
Do you find the NUJ is effective at being a trade union for journalists then, or?
I can't really speak to that because I've not been a member of the NUJ for too long. I joined sort of midway through my time at The National. Before that I was with Unite. So I can't really speak to how, you know, good good they are when you're sort of trying to organize with them, because I haven't really, as soon as I joined the NUJ, my workplace ended up closing down. I was made redundant, so I have not really had a chance to I have not really had much experience trying to sort of organize with the NUJ.
Do you know why that happened, by the way? Was it, or is this something you can't speak to? The national closing down.
My personal opinion on it is that it just was not, it was never given the chance by the larger company that owned it to succeed. I think, there were two journalists, including myself, working on it. It was a national publication. It probably needed much more than two journalists. And yeah, I think it's an issue that you get with all sort of big companies like that setting up a new thing, is that they want it to be profitable immediately. They want sort of the most bang for their buck. And unfortunately, journalism and any sort of field like that, that's just not, if you're going to get good work, that's really not how the model should work.
It really is quite infuriating that it is, when it comes to actual journalistic outlets, there's such a pressure to, like, you have to make money immediately, otherwise we're going to shut you down or we're not going to hire you. And then you have outlets like The Sun and The Times, which make huge losses, but the owner just does not care because it's just a propaganda outlet, which really is kind of the problem with, and you see this with the websites as well. You have, like, paywalls or the Guardian's system of asking for money for, like, quality journalism, and then like fake news websites would just be free because they don't have to pay, or they're run by billionaires who are just like, yeah, it's fine, just give them loads of
I
money and they'll
think
care.
part of that is because those are obviously very ideological, as you say, they're their ideological projects they used as sort of an influencing mechanism. Whereas the outlets that are, I mean, I think I can't, kind of one exception is the Bureau of Investigative Journalism that does really, really great work and provides that sort of space. But obviously they're one sort of publisher. There's no I think with places like The Guardian and stuff, there is no ideological underpinning of we want to show how this a particular structure works, or we want to show where things can be improved. It's that sort of commitment to showing something up for what it is not quite there. It's still, as you say, it's a business. There's an expectation that it's going to make money and things, and that kind of, in a lot of cases, unfortunately, does trump the desire to do good work. And with a right wing outlet, it's seen as purely, this is the arm of what the owner wants to say. And yeah.
I think it's when it comes to I was thinking about the wages thing in particular, there does seem to be a very wrong perception that journalists as a whole are part of a sort of elite middle class or very even very high middle class profession. But honestly, most of the journalists I know, from the people who I worked with on the student newspaper to yourself, it's just like it feels as if most journalists are people who are working very long hours for very little reward. And really, it's just a very small number of, like, columnists at the very top who seem to have all the money and influence. I don't know if you've had people assuming that you're better off than you are because you're a journalist.
I think, yeah, I think people do. I think it's complicated because obviously journalism is a field where you've probably seen the research on it. The industry is hugely populated by people who went to private school and people who did the double dip of going to private school and then Oxbridge and stuff. That's a huge proportion of people who make decisions, particularly editors and stuff, are privately educated and Oxbridge educated. And the way that personally, the way of getting trained and getting your first job and things, it's not set up in a way that's particularly forgiving if you're not from a particularly privileged background. My mother's a nurse, for example. I got into I started doing my master's while I was still trying to work full time, and it was really, really difficult. There is support if you're from a working class background, but you know, it involves this long application where you basically, like, you pitch a big story you want to do, or you write a big essay about, you know, why you deserve to have funding for the course you're on. You've got to give them a detailed working out list, a detailed working out of, like, what your costs for the year and what money you're asking for is. So it's like getting support in itself is kind of like a project.
That means you can't spend time doing actual journalism.
Yeah, well, it was before I got trained. So it was when I was applying to do to be a working journalist. Basically, you have to have an NCTJ qualification. I went and did a master's in news journalism and the NCTJ qualification at the same time at Cardiff Uni, and like it's expected that you sort of like study full time and you're not going to work at the same time. But obviously for me, I could, there was just no way. And the way that you get funding so that you don't have to work full time while you're doing the course is, you know, you can apply for like a diversity funding grant if you're working class or if you're from like a black minority ethnic background, etc. But as I said, it's like it's applying for that help is a thing in itself, and I wasn't able to do it because I was working and I just didn't have time. So it's you know, getting into the field is difficult. I'm still sort of financially recovering from it, and obviously I was recently made redundant as well. So I think there is huge barriers to entry if you're not from sort of a well-off background. But also, as you say, there is this like huge divide between, you know, people who work for like more prestige outlets who, you know, are paid quite a lot, people who are like on broadcast news and all the rest of it, and people who are working in local outlets that are on, you know, 20 grand, and are working sort of like hours and hours of unpaid overtime, and they have huge targets, and that's kind of a very different kettle of fish.
Some of the first work I saw from you was covering Welsh devolved politics, and I know that in England, amongst like the English left, there's a very rose-tinted literally view of Mark Drakeford. Do you think that Drakeford and his administration live up to that legend, or have they been more of a disappointment from a left-leaning perspective?
I think very much the latter, because I think the thing with Mark Drakeford and Welsh Labour's Hwyl is it's there's a branding exercise to it. They're very, I've spoken about this on podcasts before, but there's a real willingness to like talk about their own policies as like radical and progressive, and you know, they're much more like liberal in the use of, you know, words like socialism and stuff than say their equivalents across the border and all that. But when you actually look at what are they actually doing, like Mark Drakeford's actual cabinet and who he's put into important roles like housing and climate change, like the Welsh Housing Minister Julie James is kind of known at this point for in the Senedd sort of talking up the, you know, the value of landlords and their provision of housing, you know, talking about how you need to incentivize landlords to stay in the private rented sector by making sure they get a good return on their capital and things like that. These are not socialist. That's not a socialist conception of how the housing market works. You've got one or two Welsh Labour Senedd members who are comfortable talking about, you know, shrinking the private rented sector in housing, and you know, who are able to like fluently talk about, you know, why having a sort of bloated private rented sector in housing is bad. But the rest very much don't have those politics. And then at the same time, you know, a story I've done, I did not long before the National closed down, was the Welsh government's sort of quite high profile partnership with a French arms firm, Thales, who is currently being taken to court for its potential involvement in Saudi war crimes in Yemen. And you know, Mark Drakeford personally attended the opening of facilities that that took place, that you know, were part funded by Thales. Like, they're very proud of that partnership. And again, these are not something, you know, these are not decisions that would be made by a radical left-wing government. Their rollout of the free school meals policy, that's something that they've gotten a lot of kudos for. But, you know, that comes out of a cooperation deal they did with Plaid Cymru. You know, that was a fight that before the last Senedd election, you know, there was a whole fight between Plaid Cymru and Welsh Labour, because Plaid Cymru had introduced the idea of universal free school meals to the Senedd, and Labour kept voting it down. And then when they did this cooperation deal, of course, like, the universal free school meals thing was taken up and has now been rebranded as a Labour idea. Welsh Labour are very good at marketing themselves as radical, but you know, if you live here, if you're plugged into what they're actually, the decisions that are actually being made on the ground, it's really much more complicated than that. I'm not saying that, like, every person involved in Welsh Labour politics, from the grassroots and stuff, have bad politics, but the government itself are not, you know, they're not making decisions that are, like, consistent with a radical left wing sort of, you know, perspective.
For, like, years, I've looked at Welsh devolved government and thinking, like, they're doing so little. And not just in a sense of when they spend money, they spend too little or anything like that, but in the sense that they pass so very little legislation. They talk about doing things and then they don't do them for another 5 years. And it's like, what is going on? You have, like, carte blanche virtually.
Yeah, that's the thing. Labour in Wales, like, they dominate sort of every, you know, they dominate local politics, they dominate the devolved administration, they, you know, dominate in terms of, like, MPs in Westminster as well. There's really very little excuse for, like, at least sort of not trying to sort of resist some of the things that have come down. And as you say, not, you know, passing legislation. They did the Rent in Homes Wales Act was passed in 2015, 2016. That piece of legislation came into force this month. It's been a, you know, like a 6 year wait essentially to get that put in. And even then, like, the legislation, big swaths of it only apply to new tenancies created after the act comes into force. So sort of like, say myself, I'm still on a contract that was signed with my landlord last year. You know, none of the acts protect, well, I think some of them do apply to me, but for the most part, like, you know, the eviction notice period won't apply until I sign a new contract with my landlord. It's kind of like pulling teeth. I always pick on housing because I think it's such a stark example. You know, like, if you look at the SNP and Greens up in Scotland, you know, the fact that they've agreed on sort of introducing rent controls, they've put into place rent caps and eviction ban during the winter. None of that, you know, the most that Welsh Labour would agree to was, you know, exploring in a white paper the possibility of rent controls in Wales. And every time that the housing minister speaks on it, there's absolutely no confidence in the utility of rent controls on the part of the housing minister. It's spoken about in very sort of negative terms, this idea that, you know, there could be unintended consequences and all the rest of it. Similarly, like, when people, you know, asked about a rent cap and an eviction ban during the winter with the cost of living crisis this year, that was kind of dismissed out of hand as not doable.
It's so ridiculous. It's like saying, oh, it's not doable, we can't, like, practically do it. It's like, you have supreme control over all levers of government.
But the argument against it was very much that, like, oh, it would only pause the problem and you might end up having a wave of evictions at the end of when, you know, when the eviction ban is lifted, or, you know, when the rent cap's lifted. But again, that's sort of like, I think the problem with that is this just sort of, like, vacuum of, like, ideological commitment to any kind of socialist vision of the world, this idea that, like, an eviction ban or rent caps and stuff has to end.
Yes, I was going to say, you just keep doing a Biden with student debt and just keep extending the moratorium.
This idea that at some point, yeah, that this stuff has to be lifted and landlords need a guaranteed return on their investment, that without shifting that kind of worldview, you're not going to get the radical policies that kind of that people like to think that Welsh Labour is interested in doing. And I very much don't, I personally don't think they have any intention of rolling out rent controls or anything like that. Because again, like the commitment is just not there. The viewpoint is that there's certainly like a handful of MSs that do have that vision, but they're nowhere near cabinet. So, you know, and the decision not to have, voices that are sort of in favor of shrinking the PRS and stuff anywhere near cabinet, you know, that's a deliberate one, you know.
So that, no, it's a good good segue to my next question, which was, you're obviously very active about the topic of tenants' rights and landlords' wrongs. What do you think, obviously rent controls is a big thing that devolved and national government could do to improve tenants' rights. Are there any other things that come to mind in your experience as to what policies like could be done? Because obviously I'm a renter as well, so I feel this very keenly as well.
I think my view on it is always that the more that you can shrink the private rented sector, the better. Just because we're currently seeing how a sort of, you know, very poorly restrained PRS, you know, what that results in, and that results in a housing crisis. I think, you know, personally, rent controls is a start, but you know, there's things like, we've got so many empty houses that could be brought back into use, things like making council tax not the burden of tenants but the burden of who owns the property is very much something that I think is well overdue. I think the way that we have council tax in this country is very sort of regressive and kind of shifts the burden of costs of a property onto the tenant instead of the landlord.
Council tax is an obscene tax, and it's I remember delving into the ins and outs of it for Navarra and just being astonished by the fact that they haven't updated the valuation since 1990. And it's like, what? That was like 30 years ago, and they haven't changed it.
That's the thing. The basis for these things is so out of date. In the sense that when you look at housing benefit too, that the amount that people receive is also wildly out of date. Which means that people who are on benefits, people who can't work, or people who make a low wage. I recently did a piece for a really good publication called Voice.Wales, like in cooperation with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And we found that, you know, housing benefit on average would need to be raised by £200 for people to be able to easily afford the cheapest third of rented homes in Wales. More than 90% of the cheapest third of rented homes in Wales is completely, you know, beyond the reach of someone on housing benefit. The support, the mechanism for determining support is wildly out of date, as is the mechanism for, you know, determining council tax and all the rest of it. So yeah, I think there's definite, as you say, this sort of, these out of date sort of like strange labyrinthine sort of mechanisms of determining support and determining costs need to be overhauled. But ultimately, like my thing is always that you really need to shrink the private rented sector in housing. You need, you know, rank, you basically need to just disincentivize people from becoming landlords, because at the moment, like, we live in a country that kind of like the path, you know, if you're doing well, housing property is your investment. You know, people are encouraged to do it as, you know, part of their retirement, or, you know, if you come into a bit of cash, you know, maybe you buy a property, you do it up and then you flip it for more money, or you do it up and you rent it out, and that's seen as like, you know, an acceptable and kind of you know, it's the routine. It's what you do when you're better off. You know, when you've got a little bit more money, becoming a landlord is seen as the path, which means that you end up with, you know, wildly inflated property prices and a wildly inflated PRS, and you end up with a housing crisis. So,
I'm glad that somebody is saying it. It's just almost seems taboo to say something very. We should not be encouraging people to become landlords. Like, landlords are bad. Landlords are a type of role that shouldn't really exist in society. Private landlords, and even on like the centre left. Obviously, most people on the left will agree with that. But the centre left, even people like who would be considered the mainstream left, it's just a, like, no, landlords great. I mean, the shadow. I think, well, no, like, Thangam Debonair's changed roles, but she was like the housing lead for Labour for a while. Loves landlords. It's just uncontroversial.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and that's what I'm when I'm talking about the Welsh Government housing minister and stuff. Like, I don't believe she's a landlord herself, but she's very comfortable with the idea that with accepting that, you know, landlords should exist and that they provide something rather than hoarding something, which, you know, if you're someone who is part of a socialist party and you have a left wing sort of view of the world, that isn't consistent. You know, it's just the building blocks of that kind of politics is that you understand that a landlord is not providing housing, they are hoarding housing. That's just, you know, for me, 101 of socialist politics. If your housing minister doesn't accept that to be the case, then unfortunately, like, the reality of your government is that it's not left wing. Like, that's just simple to me.
It would just be like having, I don't know, a shadow health secretary who believed in private healthcare involvement in the National Health Service. Just unthinkable, you know, unthinkable. So the next question was going to be, I was listening to your, you were saying you talked about it on podcasts before. I heard an interview you did with 10,000 Posts discussing the number of politicians who are landlords. And I should read out a stat, because this is the Stats for Lefties podcast, that 115 MPs, which is 18%, are landlords, compared to around 5% of the wider adult population. Why do you think so many politicians are landlords? Because even we've already said, like, a lot of people are landlords and they're encouraged to be so, but the politicians one is like nearly 20% versus 5%. That's absurd.
Yeah, and I think that is very much to do with the fact that also becoming a politician is in itself a very exclusive occupation that's, you know, ordinarily reserved for people who are, you know, privately educated, Oxford educated, and if not those things, then they, you know, well off in some way, shape or form. You know, as I said, like, the route when you become a bit better off nowadays is very much you become a landlord, you invest in property, or, you know, you know a lot of people who do. And and again, like, even if you're not personally a landlord, like, a lot of the people who are in the sort of top ranks of electoral politics, like, they're friends with landlords, they socialize with landlords, and, you know, as you say, like, a significant proportion of them are landlords themselves, and so it sort of soaks into their view of the world and the policies they support and the decisions they make.
So the last sort of formal question I had was, obviously, I first heard of you as a journalist, but you're obviously a leftist too. And I like to ask all of my guests, partly because I don't know the answer to this question myself, which is, given that a right-wing clique currently controls the Labour Party, what is your view on engaging with that party? And if you don't favour membership, or indeed haven't before, what do you feel people should do instead?
I think, to be honest, my personal view on it is that if you're someone who is left-wing, who, you know, believes in socialist policies, doing sort of serious activism on the part of the Labour Party is just a waste of your time and energy. That's, you know, my personal thing. I don't, as I said, like, when I was talking about Welsh Labour, like, I don't think that everyone involved at the grassroots level, you know, has bad politics and all the rest of it. And I know that people have like a real attachment and a fondness for the party, but also I think you're just gonna get hamstrung at every opportunity. And I think that it's kind of a black hole for the sort of energy and enthusiasm that people have for kind of making change. It's only sort of, again, like personal view, but I think it's just only ever going to disappoint you over and over and over again. I think that really my own activity is that I pour that energy and that enthusiasm into tenant organizing. I do a lot of organizing with ACORN, which is a community and tenants union. But I think really the main avenue that people should be pouring their energy into is, if not tenant unions, then trade unions, getting workplaces organized, getting, basically, I think union politics is the way to go, because I think the reason, you know, left-wing ideas and stuff have succeeded in the past, it's always been on the back of widespread sort of blanket union membership and widespread sort of political education. And I think you can do all of those things without being a member of a political party and going out canvassing in elections. Like, and again, I think, you know, I think this worthwhile, you know, if you want to get involved with electoral politics, I think it's worthwhile if you want to do like local politics and become a councillor and kind of run as an independent. I think if you're going to do the local politics thing, you're probably better off, as I say, doing it outside of the Labour Party apparatus, just because if you do it as Labour, they, you know, you're going to be vulnerable to, you know, getting sort of suspended or and all the rest of it.
I was going to say, yeah, one of the problems with being in the Labour Party and an elected official in particular is you are dependent upon that machine, and that means they control you. Like, you know, you're not only dependent upon the party whip, but also their resources, their canvassing. You've become dependent upon that, and they take that away. The threat of taking that away is everything.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah, I think, as I say, become independent on that sort of structure is only gonna end up in disappointment, because they've shown that they're not afraid to you know, whip those resources away if you say something they don't like. And when I say that, like, that can be something as small as like liking a tweet by the Green Party. We've seen that. You know, they're really not afraid to be kind of bold in the sort of intent there. But yeah, as I was saying on 10k post recently, like, to me, like, one of the biggest joys of my life is when I go to, you know, ACORN meetings and I do ACORN cases, because it is the only thing that sort of gives me a real sense of agency over the way things are going, and gives me a real sense of kind of optimism. And I think that's going to be the same if you're involved in trade union organizing. And like, and you know, if you're not someone who is able to work, then, you know, tenant organizing is a good avenue for you. And obviously there's, you know, things like Unite Community and stuff where people organize for people exclusively who cannot work. We're not going to see sort of any real sort of radical change unless there's that kind of like blanket union membership and blanket sort of political education. And I think political education is best experienced as something that you do in sort of practice, and you do like interacting with other people in real life, not online. It needs to spring out of like having a little community of people who are all fed up in the same way that you are, and all want, you know, all, you know, everyone kind of agrees that, you know, the NHS is in crisis, that housing is in crisis and things. The education you're going to get for the best way to fix those things is by interacting with other people who are working towards the same goals. So it, yeah, I think for me the only sort of valuable use of your time and energy is going to come in kind of building up that groundswell.
Is there anything you would like to plug, like your website, Twitter account?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Wilkes Becca. It's WilksBecca. In terms of a website, I don't have one because again, I was it's made redundant this summer. I'm still kind of getting set up as a freelancer. I should have some stuff coming out in the new year.
It has been very delightful to speak to you. Very, very interesting. Thank you so much. Thank you very, very much for coming on. It was very kind of you.
Thanks so much. It was nice speaking to you.
As always, I wanted to finish by saying a particularly strong thank you to the people who have signed up as comrades on Patreon: Alex Wilson, Barry James, Bert Rothkugel, Chloe Hopkins, Chris Gravel, Daniel Rayner, Conrad, Michael Murray, Mick Mikatir, Neil Barton, Patrick Lefebvre, Pavel Kazimowski, Ruth Holliday, Stephen Carr, Thomas Alexander, Juditha De Silva. Really wonderful people. Thank you so much, guys. You make what I do possible, and I love you for it.